This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Sarah Jaffe is an independent journalist covering labor, economic justice, social movements, politics, gender, and pop culture. She is the co-host of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast, as well as a columnist at New Labor Forum. Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, is her first book. Sarah was one of the first reporters, which is how I came to know her, who covered Occupy Wall Street and the fight for 15.
And Mark Brenner is director of Labor Notes, a 38-year-old project dedicated to putting the movement back in the labor movement. He's written widely about labor movement and regularly appears as a commentator on media outlets such as Al Jazeera and NPR. He's also the co-author of several Labor Notes books, including How to Jumpstart Your Union, Lessons from the Chicago Teachers, and Secrets of a Successful Organizer.
Sarah Jaffe covers the class war one battle at a time, crisscrossing the country, asking people what they were angry about and what they were doing to take power back. And Mark Brenner knows that we don't need a crystal ball to figure out what a Trump presidency has in store for labor. National right to work legislation, outsourcing and privatizing more public services, large-scale deportations, a ban on prevailing wage laws, and this is just the tip of the iceberg.
But that's precisely what Sarah Jaffe and Mark Brenner kick into gear, insisting after we mourn, we need to organize.
Well, we're going to kick them into gear right now. Thank you for joining us, both of you. So kick me into gear, because I'm a little bit, I wouldn't say I'm in a malaise, but I'm in a little state of morbidity about organized labor, the big labor unions. Tell me, we've moved from a period of where they, I think, capitulated to the mandate of the Democratic Party and got very little in return, and now are hardly rambunctious in the face of this incredible juggernaut of the Republicans and what they portend for the workers of the world. So what's your analysis about where we're at with organized labor? You're so deeply immersed in it. Am I missing something? Or do we have to look to the new formations and organizations?
Well, Mimi,
who do you
think
want to go first?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead. It's all you.
All right, Mark, we got it, and then Sarah, just take it.
Yeah. Go
okay.
Ahead.
So in terms of the labor movement, I will say I've been in the labor movement for 20 years, and I actually have never been more optimistic. And I know that probably will surprise you and surprise others listening, but I think everywhere I look, things that I couldn't have imagined 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, are happening around the country. I mean, I think that it's true for the sort of top-level union leadership, what most people think of as the labor movement. They're always going to be the last of the party, and I think they're always going to be the weakest link in terms of resisting the kinds of policies that the Trump administration are going to bring down on us and the things that corporations have been doing to us for, you know, two or three generations now. But whether it's kind of figuring out new approaches to joining the Black Lives Matter movement, or really building some amazing work with community allies and non-union janitors in Minneapolis, what unions are doing to do that, or just responding to the Open Shop America conditions that Scott Walker rammed through in Wisconsin. I see tons of activism and organizing at the grassroots, and I think that you know, when the financial collapse hit in 2008, it wasn't really until 2011 with Wisconsin that we really started to see a spark, a response. And I think that we're not going to have to wait 3 years for this one, thank God.
Yeah, I agree with Mark. I'm actually more optimistic about the broad left and about the future of sort of class politics right now in America than I have ever been. And that means that what we have is a generation of young people who are radicalized, whether it's by Wisconsin or Occupy Wall Street or Bernie Sanders, that are thinking of themselves as workers, and they're thinking of themselves as part of a working class, and they're thinking of that as a political identity, a political home, and the political work that they want to do. And that's just incredible. And, you know, as far as the existing you know, I think Mark and I would agree that there's labor institutions and there's a labor movement, and sometimes they're the same thing and sometimes they're not. And some labor institutions have responded well to Trump. I was just speaking with folks from SEIU, United Service Workers West, on strike on May Day in solidarity with non-union immigrant workers, while others, of course, you know, many of the building trades have turned up in meetings with Trump and gotten, you know, gotten a photo op for their efforts and not much else. And so this is a moment for that part of labor to decide which side it's on, because only one of those sides is actually, you know, going to do anything for workers, and the other one is just going to hasten the decline of the existing labor institutions that we've got.
Mark, when I think of labor, I always think of all of these different struggles which are played out in isolation, even within the, quote, labor movement, end quote, and then the labor movement itself being so isolated from all the other movements and all the other things that are happening. But you and Labor Notes have been reporting on some things in which that is not the case, and especially with regard to immigrant workers. You want to talk about that?
Do you mean sure. They're building bridges?
No, building bridges, planting seeds. I mean, I think we can use
making
a lot of
trouble,
analogies.
Yeah.
Making trouble is the one that we choose usually. That's right, Ken. And I think that we're seeing a lot of really promising work in the labor movement. And, you know, to be fair, stuff that's been going on for quite some time. I mean, we just wrote a piece in our magazine from a hospital worker in California who was talking about the union he's part of. 9 out of 10 folks in his workplace are immigrants, many if not most of them undocumented. So his union, you know, for his union, this question of how to deal with immigration in the Trump era was not a question, right? Because it wasn't a question before Trump. I mean, this was an immigrant union, and they were defending immigrant workers, and they've been part of all of the kind of organizing that's been happening, that like what Sarah described, the United Service Workers West are doing out in California. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of unions now doing that in a way that we weren't in 2006 when the last big May Day marches were happening. I'm happy to see more unions are kind of knitting together with those higher profile efforts. But I think that what's even more promising is the stuff that doesn't always make the headlines. Like I was mentioning earlier in Minneapolis, just watching the way that unionized janitors, most of whom are immigrants, about, you know, like 24 different countries represented in the janitors union in the Twin Cities, working with non-union janitors that are part of a worker center there called Setul, and, you know, yeah, building bridges to predominantly African-American community organizations and the church groups there. It's a real model for the kinds of things labor can do. And, you know, to be fair, in certain places have been doing for some time. I just think, as yeah, Sarah was saying, it's just, there's a lot of people that are not there yet and aren't going to get there until the, you know, some folks at the base, you know, and their membership light a fire under them. But fortunately, we're seeing more and more of that too.
Yeah. I see you nodding your head, Sarah. So,
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be able to be a labor reporter other than Labor Notes. There was nobody doing this full time, really, when I started trying to be a labor reporter back in, you know, 2008, 2009. And now, you know, I can get somebody to send me across the country to go write a story about retail workers. And I'm getting these requests from, like, I'm working on a story for Rack.com, which is a fashion website that wanted a big piece on the state of retail workers. And that's just, you know, there's, again, I can't stress enough that there's a sense now in this country, based on, you know, the actual lived experience of most people, which is of downward mobility, of stagnant incomes, of lousy working conditions, and straight up job loss, that people are really thinking about what their position is in the workplace and what that means. And that, you know, when we see things like an organizing boom among journalists, you have people who didn't think of themselves as working class before who are now thinking of themselves that way, and they are organizing, and they are taking hints from people who've been doing this for a long time. And so, you know, again, the connections being made, not just among workers in similar fields, but workers in very different fields sometimes, is really impressive right now.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Ken really opened up with this before, which is that as a whole, we're rather compartmentalized. There are lots of people doing a lot of good things. And I would say over the years that more of my comrades within the quote-unquote left movement gravitated less to workplace organizing and organizing from the seat of production, but in the community sphere. And loads of wonderful and exciting human rights-based issues came out of the community sphere. I'm beginning to see, though, now a breaking down of those barriers, a somewhat less compartmentalization and more of a melding of the community labor sphere. And I pick this up a lot from your own work in Jackson, Mississippi, where you were talking about Chokwe Lumumba. And I wonder if that's both of your impression, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about what got you down to Jackson.
Well, this is basically the premise of my book, right, is that there is all of this unrest right now, and that these movements are broadly connecting to each other in a way that they hadn't before. And I think that that's very, it's visible in a lot of places. In Jackson, the work that they've been doing down there, the folks with Cooperation Jackson, and the first campaign that they ran with Chokwe Lumumba for mayor when he won in 2013 and then unfortunately died in office after just a couple of months, leaving a lot of work unfinished. It was really this fascinating question of what can we do if we think about self-determination for the working people of Jackson, Mississippi, 80-something percent of whom are Black. And so that means you have to think about it. And so I interviewed Chokwe Antar Lumumba just recently, and I think he said, if you've got, 85% of your population is left-handed, you've got to have some left-handed jobs. You've got to think about who the people are that you're working with and what their different needs are and how to create a movement and create a space for everybody within that. And it's an endlessly fascinating thing, because especially after this election, there's been a lot of this kind of recrimination of any place, not even any person, but any place that could have voted for Donald Trump, and that, we should just let them secede, and they should just, basically the outlook from a lot of liberals even has been basically that those people should just go die. And that leaves out things like the organizing that's going on in Jackson, Mississippi, the fact that many, many of these southern cities in these states that are run by just, straight up white supremacist governors and legislatures. Most of these cities are they're majority Black. They're still, fairly liberal, but they're limited in what they can do from the state government. And like we here in New York know about being limited in what we can do from the state government.
Mark, Labor Notes also does these troublemakers schools. What's that all about? And also, you get a lot of rank-and-file workers in there, and how do they relate to each other, being from different unions, because mostly people relate just to people within their own union?
Goodness, but I'd like to get a PhD in troublemaking.
I think you have one, Mimi. I think you have one already.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't have a piece of paper.
Kind of a de jure.
I'll send you one, Mimi. I'll send you a degree.
Good.
I think that something that is really true in my experience as an activist and rabble rouser, which is that, there is this profound sense of isolation that you often have. You kind of get in your own sphere and your own silo, and you're doing your own thing. And it's hard to connect what you're doing to other things that, intellectually, you should be, those are dots you should be connecting. But that's also true even inside of the labor movement. I mean, think about it. Most union members probably don't ever even have much opportunity to talk to other folks in their own union if they don't work on the same shift or in the same unit or in the same department with them, much less folks from other unions. And this is just a long-standing, deep-seated weakness in our movements, because we think about them as institutions, the way Sarah was saying, and not as movements. And so, maybe the president of your union knows people from other unions, but that's not actually how we build power as a labor movement, or how we actually build bridges into the community. So I think that one of the things that Labor Notes has always done best is figuring out ways to bring rank and filers from all different industries, all different unions, and plenty of people doing worker struggles that are not part of the union movement, but they're part of the broader labor movement, together to kind of make common cause, to build connections. And you see these seeds really start to grow over time. I mean, I think that a lot of the really exciting work to me is where we've kind of watched some of that take off in places like Chicago, where, you know, the troublemaking wing of the labor movement is not waiting around for what the labor officials want to do. You know, these are the folks who are backing Rahm Emanuel and, you know, basically conceding to the austerity agenda that Democrats and Republicans alike are pushing on us. And there's plenty of people now, actually, I would say a growing number, who are breaking away from that and standing up. And this is also, for my money, the part of the labor movement that has the best chance of building the real alliances with the community that you're talking about, Mimi. And so I'm very excited about how, you know, how we see that spread and what that turns into, because I think that's where, you know, we have some real, if you look at Chicago as a microcosm of what's possible in terms of labor and community together, it's really exciting.
And, of course, Ken and I have fallen in love with the nurses' union, which is certainly understandable. And they've been there. They've been there. They've been there for every issue. They've broken through the gender and the race barriers that have inhibited our developments for millennial. Sarah, what do you think the Democrats don't get about? I'm sorry, that was that was a little too global. I'm about to narrow it down. What don't they get about the working class and organizing the working class, organizing them in the electoral arena, or for that matter, what do many people in the progressive movement not get about immersing themselves in the struggles of the working class, and who's gotten it?
Oh, goodness. I don't think, I mean, not enough people have gotten it. But so the tendency, and I was just talking about this with a friend earlier, the tendency is to treat class like another sort of identity box that you check off, so that like working class becomes code for identity politics for white people, and often particularly white men. And so when you hear this sort of Democrats are like, we have to figure out how to talk to the working class, we get things like Labor Secretary Tom Perez is the head of the Democratic National Committee saying curse words on the campaign trail, because that apparently is going to appeal to working class people. Like, come on, man. Really? That's what you think? And that's literally the image that we're getting here, right? Or then you get things like saying that we have to go and we have to campaign with and run candidates who are anti-abortion or anti-gay, because that's something working class, which is presuming that like racism and sexism and homophobia are traits that, you know, come from poor people rather than are, you know, well, anyway, I could talk about this for literally hours, but let me just back to the main subject. I was just in Indiana spending some time with the workers at the Carrier plant, whose jobs Donald Trump supposedly triumphantly saved, and the workers at the Rexnord plant around the corner, whose jobs are still going to Mexico. And talking to people, you know, I'm talking to a guy who literally has a Eugene Debs button on his bag, who voted for Donald Trump. And I'm saying, this guy is not the enemy, right? This guy is not somebody who, you know, is just so horrified and driven by, you know, racism and whatever, and is just like a dyed-in-the-wool conservative who's never going to go back. But he's sitting there. His job is about to get shipped to Mexico. And he's wondering who is going to say anything, do anything about this. And the Democratic Party hands him Hillary Clinton. And the last name Clinton means NAFTA in the Midwest and in a lot of other parts of the country, but particularly in the industrial Midwest, right? Indiana is the state in this country that still has the highest density of manufacturing per capita, but that is, it's also the one that's losing manufacturing jobs the fastest. And so when you don't have an answer for that guy, and it isn't saying whatever on the campaign trail, it's actually like coming to Indianapolis and going to the plant and saying like, we understand the global phenomenon that's going on here, and we need to do something about it. And we can't just give you, you know, mealy mouse, whatever, and turn around and say we're now against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, when, you know, a year ago you were calling it the gold standard. Literally every worker that I spoke with in Indiana quoted that gold standard line to me. You know, and this idea that like you know, again, that we got to play to some sort of weird identity of white working class masculinity, rather than understand that, like, A, half the jobs at Carrier are done by people of color. There are a lot of women in that plant, too, who are either got their jobs saved or are still losing their jobs because 550 of them are still going to Mexico. The Democrats don't have the first clue of even what it means to say class, let alone, like, do something that would actually help the working class.
And we never have enough time, and this kind of conversation should take hours. So I want to ask both Sarah Jaffe and Mark Brenner, what is it that you would respectively like to leave us with as we think about really rekindling, or as both of you say, really putting the movement back in the labor movement, in the workers' movement? Because we don't mourn. We just use that as a way of propping ourselves up to kick into gear to organize. Mark, let's start with you, and then we'll give it over to Sarah.
Sure. A.J. Musty talked about the labor movement as part army, part town hall, and I think we've been pretty weak on both scores. I think we need to really revamp both arms, both muscles. I think, you know, in addition to being out on the streets targeting the kinds of things we've been talking about on the show that Trump's doing, we can't forget our big targets about the bankers and the billionaires and all the corporate executives who've been doing damage to the working class in this country for far longer than Trump's been on the political scene. But we can't lose sight of the town hall either in terms of talking about strategies really helping folks be equipped to lead, bridging the differences between Trump voters, between races, all the things that split us apart. I think that to do a lot of that, we're going to have to get back to the basics. Part of one of the things we're focused a lot on at Labor Notes right now is the old, you know, the real hardcore nuts and bolts of how do you organize? Because frankly, we need exponentially more people in our movement that can do that if we're going to respond to the challenges that we face. So, like I said, I've never been more optimistic. But we need to get out in the streets and get going.
And how optimistic can you be in the 60 seconds we have left, Sarah?
I mean, I agree with Mark. People are always, my pet peeve is all these articles about, like, can X, Y, Z thing save the labor movement? And I'm like, you know what's going to save the labor movement? Organizing is going to save the labor movement. There's no shortcuts. There's no quick fixes. There are new technologies and new techniques and new things that we can learn and share with each other and communicate better. Like, we can absolutely do a heck of a lot better at that. That's why Mark and I do what we do. But I think, you know, the lesson is just, as you keep saying, right, don't mourn, organize.
You've got to read Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, Sarah Jaffe's book, and you've got to pick up Labor Notes, easy to find online. It is chock full of stimulating, exciting information, because some of us get a little parochial from time to time, and these folks help us break out of our sometimes tunnel vision. Special thanks to Mark Brenner, Sarah Jaffe. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
And now Max Claxon's new version of the International.
Arise, you workers, from your slumber, all you wage slaves, everyone.
The revolution comes like thunder, and the age of hypocrisy is done.
Their televised illusion. Stand up and look them in the eyes. rally unites the human race.
Been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.